Wondering if you should stay in Illinois or move out of state? Get your copy of Scott Tucker's book, Escape Illinois, Should I Stay or Should I Go? Get your complimentary copy at retirementdakota.com.
Investment advisory services are made available through AE Wealth Management, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
Scott Bauer, our friend and CEO of Prosper Trading Academy, is on the phone line. Welcome back, Scott. Thanks for joining us.
Always a pleasure, John. How are you?
Good. Did you know the market was going to have the nice bump it's had the last couple days?
Oh, of course. I've got that crystal ball like everybody else does, right?
Well, let's put it this way. If you knew the jobs numbers were going to be, the unemployment number was going to be what it was. Actually, that wasn't the unemployment number. That was the inflation number. But you would have guessed that the market would have reacted positively, right?
Absolutely. And you know, I think it's a little bit of an overreaction, unfortunately. It's obviously very nice. It's very welcome. In fact, the NASDAQ has rallied so far off of the bottom, it's actually now out of what has been known as a bear market, and it's in a bull market right now. But I think we've taken this a little bit too far. And the reason I say that, John, is because there's still, in my opinion, so many things overriding from a macroeconomic standpoint to a geopolitical standpoint that, to me, can still hold this market up. You know, we're still battling inflation. It's that CPI report is a little bit lower, which is great. It's welcome, but inflation is still exceedingly high. We're still battling whether we're in or not a recession, depending on the definition of what you want, you know, to call it. But most importantly to me, the geopolitical risks of still what is going on in Russia and Ukraine, which is still disrupting supply chains, still disrupting, you know, getting food and grain out to the world. And those problems haven't been solved yet. So am I looking for the market to retrace back down to the lows? No, I'm not. But I think we got a little bit ahead of ourselves on the last week or so.
I got to tell you, I just was laughing at the idea. I mean, it's not funny, but you know, the Illinois license plate stickers that show when you have to renew your plate, that little tag that you stick on there is different this year because of supply chain issues. It's amazing.
It is. And it's funny because I actually went to the emissions control last week with one of my cars and had a renew. And you're right. It just says the year. It doesn't have all the other info on there or whatever. So you're right. I mean, everything you can imagine has been affected by supply chains. And unfortunately, I don't think that's going away anytime soon.
I guess so. But, you know, we seem to be getting along. I forgot what it used to be like without supply chain issues. You are more pessimistic than a lot of people we've been talking to the last few days.
I am only pessimistic that this recent rally has gone too quickly. I am still very optimistic terms of the market 6 months from now. I think the market needs to take a breather right now. Volatility, which we know has been extremely high over the last 6 months, year, 18 months, is now down to a level where we were about 5 months ago in the middle of April. To me, the volatility in the market is too cheap. So if, you know, as a trader, I'm actually looking to hedge or protect some of my positions by buying some volatility. Again, I'm not anticipating, John, that the market is going to sell off 5, 10, 15% from here, but I think that it does need to calm down, and I think a nice little, you know, a nice little pullback of 2, 3, 4% will give people actually some confidence to maybe reload and get back into the market.
What would you do then? What's your hedge here?
Well, I really, you know, if we get that pullback, I do like the possibility of getting back into some of these growth stocks, especially in the tech side of things, because the reason that the NASDAQ and the tech stocks sold off so heavily was really because of interest rates. We saw the 10-year just rocket above 3% all the way to like 3.4%. And these high-tech growth stocks, they depend very much on borrowing for future investment. So when rates go higher, that impacts their bottom line. Now that rates have subsided into a more manageable, more reasonable area here, I think that is a really good look going out to the future, a really good sector, a really good space to put some money to work.
Scott Bauer is the CEO of Prosper Trading Academy. This is what he does and shows people how to do. ProsperTrading.com. Okay, Scott, we'll check in again. Thanks for your time today.
Thanks, John. Have a great day.
Ian Schur, editor-at-large at CNET. Hello again, Ian.
How you doing?
I'm doing well. Talk to me about Disney Plus. The price is going up.
Yeah, so inflation's hitting everywhere, it feels like. Disney said that they're going to raise the price of their streaming service, right, Disney Plus, which, if you remember, is very popular. It has been able to pull in tens of millions of people in the last couple of years since it launched. And they're going to increase the price by $3 per month. So it's going to go from $8 a month that it is today to $11 a month. And what they're going to do is create a new ad-based version. So essentially like Disney TV, right, where suddenly you're going to have to watch ads in the middle of whatever you're watching. And that will be $8 per month. So people who want to continue paying $8 per month can, but they're going to have to start watching ads. And if you don't want to watch ads, you have to pay a little more. They're doing that also on Hulu, and they're doing it with some of the others.
Yeah, we were watching Hulu the other night, and a commercial came on, and my wife turned to me, and she said, oh, it's TV now.
Well, Hulu has always had commercials. It's been a very interesting thing. I remembered when Hulu launched, and it had commercials built in, and it was an interesting idea to have that TV experience. Then I think what the problem exists now is that as these companies are trying to figure out, you know, partially it's capitalism, right? They're trying to grow their profits and their business, but also it's that the number of people who have streaming services is always fluctuating, right? People leave, they come back, maybe they're done with it, they only wanted to watch Stranger Things. Now they're done until Bridgerton season 3 comes out. Mm-hmm. And in the meantime, they're not paying Netflix. And the problem is that they need to find ways to make that money consistent. And so offering advertising is a way to do that. But it is jarring for those of us who have gotten used to the idea of, you know, especially my little kids, they're not used to seeing ads on TV at all.
Well, so who's winning the platform wars then? I think we all thought that the 800-pound gorilla was Netflix. Are they still the number one streamer? Who's where?
Yeah, I think you might want to put them around, you know, maybe 400 pounds now. They've definitely felt the pressure of competition. And Netflix is still one of the leading streaming companies out there. That's not changing. But they're not growing at all as fast as Disney, for example. In the meantime, HBO has shockingly been struggling a little bit, right? You may have heard, and we've written on CNET about how they're struggling to find enough content, right, enough movies and TV shows that are compelling. And while they have some real winners there, they just cut the Batgirl movie from their lineup, which caused a huge shock around the movie industry, in part because the movie was done practically. And they had like the lead walking around in her costume, and like everyone knew it was coming, and they just decided to cut it. So I think that there's a lot of one of the interesting things we're seeing is it's not just who is the 800-pound gorilla, who is the name that everyone knows. It's also who has the right stuff, right? And oddly enough, people like Apple have come out of nowhere and suddenly won an Oscar. And in the meantime, we see people who have been doing this forever, like HBO, in a weird way, struggling.
Apple, what was the Oscar winner for Apple Plus TV?
So that was Coda, the movie about hearing the deaf family. Mm-hmm. And by the way, you know, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention the Emmys that they've been either nominated or won, either for stuff like The Morning Show or Severance is up for a bunch of Emmys. I was really impressed with that show. So there's definitely a lot that, you know, that Apple's been able to do, but it underscores how being an expert at Hollywood does not guarantee success on any level.
I saw this morning that The Morning Show is going to get a third season. Jon Hamm will have a big role in season 3, and they're going to start filming that. Okay, one last question about all of this. If I only had two platforms, and I know you'll probably say, well, it depends on what you want to watch or what you like, but would you say that there were two obvious choices? It seems to me like Netflix still has to be one. What else?
It depends. It really depends.
I know.
I'm sorry, but let me put it this way. We have a really good breakdown on CNET of all the different offerings from all the different companies to help you figure that stuff out. But part of it really is, like, if you love comic book movies, obviously you're going for Disney, right? But if you don't care for that stuff, then maybe it doesn't make sense. And that's the thing, is they've all kind of found their own little niches that work really well for them. But those niches mean not all of us are going to be subscribing to the same stuff.
Google is changing its algorithm, maybe, to get me more accurate information. Am I reading that right?
Well, they hope, at least. You know, I think what's interesting is that there's a survey that was conducted by Pointer and YouGov that found that 62% of people say they see false or misleading information online every week. And I'm sure that that's an undercount, right? Being online as much as I am and seeing the disinformation world as much as I do, it's pervasive and constant. And so what Google said is that they're going to try and do a better job of seeking out the correct information and also checking against what they say are high quality sources. Now, that will probably cause half of the people listening to start debating all of that immediately. And that is part of the struggle that Google is in, is that unfortunately, even who a source is that can be trustworthy has suddenly become an object of debate. And it's become a huge issue to figure out what is the truth. And you have to remember, Google's, when they were founded, their founding principle was to organize all of the world's information and make it easily accessible. Well, unfortunately, they did not figure out how to make sure that that information was right.
So if you want to say that FBI agents planted evidence at Mar-a-Lago, there's no evidence to prove that. I would bet that that's not true. I wonder how you would score that and what you would do with that.
Well, I think the key question is it coming from Joe Nobody's Twitter feed? Is it coming from a very highly visited blog, right, whether they be hard left or hard right, or is it coming from a mainstream news publication? And those are the things that Google, in a lot of ways, has never really wanted to have to figure out, because they don't like having to be the arbiters of truth. Right? I respect the fact that they want to just be a platform. But the unfortunate thing is that because there are so many people acting in bad faith, right, and publishing things they know to be untrue, but trying to make it true, it undoes the whole system, and it makes it incredibly hard for these things to work correctly.
Sure, and I think, you know, if somebody says there's two moons and they're made of goat cheese, we know that's not true, and maybe you deplatform that, but I think it is more complicated. My example is a bad one. Let's say Donald Trump was robbed of the last election. That's not true, but mainstream media and mainstream politicians are saying that. So maybe Joe Buckethead is putting that out there too, but what do you do with that sort of misinformation?
It is really tough. And, what you know, this is an ongoing conversation in the media world, and it's something we at CNET have actually become a part of that conversation. We've published our own view on this thing, and particularly the debate about the word lie, right? Because for the longest time, at the beginning of the Trump administration, people like the New York Times, the Washington Post, were very remiss to use the word lie at all, because it suggests that the person knows that they're telling a non-truth. But now they use it a lot. And I think that that's part of the way that things have changed over the last few years.
That has become part of Donald Trump's team's defense, that you have to have known it. And even though people said that, if you don't believe it, then is it a lie? Which seems to be a very convenient construct to me, but that's part of the conversation right now. That's fascinating stuff, Ian. As always, Schur is the editor-at-large at CDET.com. We'll talk again, Ian. Thank you.
Absolutely. Take care.
Yeah, you already see some Halloween stuff, but you sure see plenty of back-to-school stuff, too. Folks are paying more for that stuff now. Bankrate.com's been following the cost of these things, and Ted Rossman is a senior industry analyst there. Welcome back, Ted.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
But the inflation numbers are ticking down a little bit. So have the prices on these things come down? And what's the general trend this year?
The general trend is still up, although not as much as some other things. I thought this was interesting. The National Retail Federation said that the average K through 12 student's family is going to be spending $864 per child on back-to-school shopping this year. And that's everything from pens and pencils to electronics and clothing and backpacks and all in $864. That's only up 1.8% year over year. So not as bad as the inflation we're seeing in other areas. However, it's up 24% over the past 3 years. So I think there is a cumulative effect to this. Our survey found that a lot of people are concerned about the cost of back to school shopping. And I think that's also in the broader context of higher gas prices, higher food prices, higher housing costs. I think people are getting squeezed all around.
Do you think the expectation is worse than the reality, though?
I think it depends. You know, we noticed that middle-income households are getting hit the most, which surprised me. You would think that lower-income households would be having the toughest time with inflation. I think in some respects they are, but I think, sadly, it's not a new struggle for that group. I think what is new is this middle-income group, which we defined as annual incomes between $50,000 and $100,000 a year. That group, I think, is feeling this more than usual. So they're feeling that it's back to school, it's food, it's gas, it's housing, it's everything. And, like, where is this money going to come from? I think the cumulative effect of high inflation, higher interest rates, people have dipped into their savings. Increasingly, people are taking on debt. We actually saw credit card debt jump 13% year over year in the second quarter. So we're definitely seeing this stacking up. And I do think it's interesting that the middle class seems to be the most stressed about it.
Are you saying that the first group is used to having to forego things? The second group has always been able to find a way, but now they're ironically feeling the pinch more.
I think that's a good way to put it. And specifically, we found that almost half of back-to-school shoppers are going to be seeking out more coupons and discounts and sales this year. We found 36% are buying fewer school items. 35% are trading down to cheaper brands. We see 31% stretching current items another year. There's a lot of creativity being deployed out there as people are trying to cut corners and do what they can to save money. And I think it makes a lot of sense. You know, I would add things like those buy nothing groups and the ability to get something used or secondhand. Every little bit counts. And, you know, maybe you can find some ways to save rather than shelling out these hundreds and hundreds of dollars.
What about the upper income group? I guess the inflation is there, but they're above $100,000, not noticing it as much?
Not as much, but still significant. Even there, 39% of people with $100,000 or more in annual household income, 39% say that inflation is changing their back-to-school shopping habits as well. So not quite as much as the middle class, but still a lot. And, you know, I think that it is definitely very relevant right now that these things have become mainstream. You know, you remember inflation started out as more niche categories like used cars and lumber, and then it turned into more of a gas kind of story. I think what's concerning now is that it's food and housing that are leading the way, two things that we absolutely need. So even though we got a more encouraging inflation report yesterday, as some people say, one in a row is not a streak. And the other thing is that it's plateaued, at least for now, at a pretty high level. And I still think we need to make more noticeable progress on the inflation front. You know, I think there are signs that it's starting to dent consumer spending, and people are making trade-offs, and they're saying, well, I need to spend this on back to school, so I can't spend this on somewhere else. And that's not great for discretionary sectors.
Is that housing thing the most worrisome?
Probably, because it's a big ticket item, but also because there's a lag to it. Like, if you're a renter, your rent may only reset once a year. So that's something that it's a big ticket item, but then it's going to be a year before it goes down. And in fact, it probably won't go down. There's probably going to be a build off that higher base for next year. You know, this relates to what the Fed is concerned about with some so-called wage price spiral, where then, because we're facing higher costs everywhere, people demand higher wages at work, which is great as a worker, but then if all these companies raise prices, then it's not great as a consumer. So the Fed's trying to avoid that. I don't want to be too negative. I mean, we did see some initial signs that inflation may be starting to ease, but my point is that it's still leveled off, at least for now, at a high point. You know, even if we say, oh, there was no inflation from June to July, well, that's still off a very high base. So maybe early signs of progress. I know Wall Street's been cheering this just with a forward look towards, all right, maybe what the Fed's doing is starting to work, but their job is not done. We're probably going to see another point, maybe point and a quarter of interest rate increases by the end of the year.
Talk to me about interest rates for a second. On credit cards, on purchasing power, what numbers are you seeing? Are people putting school supplies on their plastic?
They are, yeah. Number one was actually a debit card at 57%, so people are debt conscious there. Second was cash, which I thought was interesting. 46% are using credit, 30% paying in full. That's great. You get the rewards and you avoid interest. 21% financing over time. That's more concerning. And then when you add in people using those buy now, pay later services like Affirm and Afterpay, it gets you to about 30% of back-to-school shoppers taking on some sort of debt. Now, maybe that's short-term interest-free debt in the case of buy now, pay later. But on credit cards, the average interest rate is about 17.5%. I think in the coming weeks, it'll go over 18%, which would establish a new all-time record. I think this is contributing to what's making it harder for people to get out of debt. So we're talking about reduced savings. We're talking about higher costs for everything, higher interest rates. My best tip is to get a 0% balance transfer card. These last as long as 21 months. They can really help you get out of debt at a lower cost.
Well, you talk about your inflation, 8%, how about 18%? And you said if we get to 18% on the average, that'll be an all-time high?
It will, yeah. And I think we are going to hit that in the next few weeks, unfortunately, just based on the rate hike that we recently got. It takes a few weeks or even a few months for that to fully bake through the system. And that's part of what makes it hard for the Fed to kind of thread this needle that, you know, credit card rates usually adjust within a month or two, but some of what they're doing, it may take 6, 9, 12 months to really filter through the economy. So that's where they want to tap the brakes, but not hit them too hard. I think what we can control as households is trying whenever possible to boost those savings, pay down that high cost credit card debt, maybe with a 0% balance transfer card or a side hustle or cutting your expenses. But then some of this becomes self-fulfilling, right? Because it's consumer spending that powers the economy. So it's a delicate balance. But I think at the individual level, we do what we can to save.
Ted Rossman, senior industry analyst at Bankrate.com. Okay, Ted, good job. Thanks for your help today.
My pleasure. Thanks.
More business news now on the Wintrust Business Lunch with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Chicago's inflation rate fell last month, according to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, but it was still fourth highest in the country in July. Consumer prices fell 0.2% over the past month, but were up 8.8% from a year ago. Most U.S. cities saw inflation numbers cool after months of going up. Chicago was behind Tampa, Dallas, and Riverside, San Bernardino, California. Tampa's year-over-year inflation rate was 11.2%. Chicago's energy index fell 4.1% thanks to a drop in gas prices. Used car prices also fell. Los Angeles had an inflation rate of 7.7%, and New York's came in at 6.5%. The private equity firm Invest Industrial has a deal in place to acquire a portion of a suburban packaged food company's meal prep business. Bloomberg reports the deal with Treehouse Foods is valued at $950 million. The Oak Brook-based Treehouse announced last year it was exploring a sale of some of its business. Treehouse, which makes private label grocery items, will use proceeds of the sale to pay down debt and strengthen its balance sheet. The company has been looking to boost shareholder value. The meal prep business, being acquired by Invest Industrial, makes products like pasta, sauces, condiments, and pie filling. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Whoops, turn on your microphone. And now the business of food, and here's Steve Alexander.
And I'm happy to tell you we are sponsored by the Chevy Silverado HD. Experience life in HD. Visit ChevyDriveChicago.com. Several years ago, a new kind of vending machine started showing up in Chicago, something called Farmer's Fridge. And the first one I saw was in the Hancock building.
Yeah, that's right. We actually had one in the gym there. It's probably still there.
Luke Saunders is the founder and CEO of Farmer's Fridge, and they are all over the place now.
Yeah, we have over 250 fridges in Chicago alone.
And all over the country, too. Airports, office buildings, hospitals, and more.
So the whole idea for Farmer's Fridge is to make fresh, healthy food as accessible as a candy bar. And we do that by making fresh food every day and then delivering it to retail stores, automated smart fridges, and people's homes across 42 states.
And the idea for all of this? Well, Luke says it came from his previous gig as a traveling salesman.
I was driving 1,000 miles a week. There was really nothing except for fast food and gas stations. And I had this idea that if you could get fresh food into a vending machine, you could put it in more places, it would be more convenient, like all the locations you just mentioned. And all that would be required is basically rebuilding the supply chain from scratch. So we actually started in the shared kitchen on the west side of Chicago. Since then, we've scaled it up and we operate in a large food manufacturing setting by Midway Airport.
The vending machines are wrapped in a distinctive earthy, farmy, wood-like exterior. And while Farmer's Fridge is known for salads in a jar, it also sells wraps and bowls, yogurt, and more, all in the $5 to $9 range. And there's recycling.
There's actually a jar return right on the fridge.
And food that does not get sold is donated to the community, which is part of Farmer Fridge's DNA that really shined when the pandemic shut down hospital cafeterias.
We raised money to donate meals and partnered with hospitals to provide meals for frontline workers.
Yeah, giving back while the pandemic was taking away.
We lost about 87% of our revenue in 2 weeks, but then got all of it back within a few months because we had added those new channels.
Luke Saunders, founder and CEO of Chicago's very own Farmer's Fridge. From the farm to your belly, today is National Panini Day and National Raspberry Tart Day. That's the business of food on 720 WGN.
The executive director of the Friends of the Chicago River is Margaret Frisbee. Margaret, you're on WGN. How are you?
I'm well, John. How are you?
I'm good. What's a float party? What are you guys doing?
Well, a float party is when 500 people put on life jackets and bring out their festive floaty toys, giant chickens, unicorns, inner tubes, whatever you got, and float down the river on the North Branch from River Park to Clark Park on Sunday this week.
River Park. So walk me through this. So where am I going to be floating? From where to where?
Yeah, so River Park is on the north side of the city. Picture Foster Avenue and about Kedzie.
Oh, up there.
And
okay. Yeah.
It's a lovely park with a boat dock and a river lab and a field house. A lot of people are familiar with it. There's a pool, but there's also access to the river. There's a floating dock. And so people are signing up for the Chicago Summer Float Party, and they will be putting in on their floaty toys and floating downstream from River Park to Clark Park. And for orientation, Clark Park is about, it's behind, Lane Tech High School. That's a good landmark. So it's a couple miles. It'll take about 2 hours or so, and hopefully people just enjoy the river and help us celebrate how much cleaner the river has become.
Over by Lane Tech, they've done some work along the river there, right? They've put a walkway in there and done some landscaping.
Yeah, it's just a wonderful place. So there is a boathouse, there's a floating dock,
Yeah. There
is the River 312 River Run, which is a flyover bike path that goes over the river from the east side to the west side. So it creates miles and miles of continuous river trail. So it's a great place just to go hang out, or it's a good place to get on the river or ride your bike north.
Is this like a pub crawl? Am I consuming anything along the way?
No, not till the end. But that's a great party. We are having a celebration at Clark Park following the float. So from about 2 o'clock till 5 o'clock, people can hang out in the park with us. And Molson Coors is one of our sponsors, and so there will be, a festive beverage to be had if you're interested. And, you know, mostly in food trucks and music. And, you know, it's to paint, you know, a very festive atmosphere and just give people a chance to have some fun.
Is this a fundraiser for your organization?
It is, you know, much like, you know, many runs, running races, et cetera, you know, we've got a fee covering the cost of putting on the event, and then anything left over will help us to improve and protect the Chicago River into the future.
So what's it cost me to float with you guys?
Your basic ticket's $45, and that includes free shuttles from Clark Park, so you can either get there on public transportation or drive your car. You can park at Clark Park, and then we'll shuttle you up with your floaty toy to River Park, and you float back, and then it covers the cost of the music and the, you know, everything else included. And everyone gets a free t-shirt that says, "I floated the Chicago River with friends."
I will need to provide my own life jacket and floaty toy, right?
That's right, yeah. Everyone will
how
have to get
the
some
river there?
Beg, borrow, or steal. Pardon me?
How deep is the river as I'm floating along?
Yeah, you know, most of it's not very deep. You know, it's 3 feet, 4 feet, you know, maybe in a few places even five, but it's pretty shallow up there. And, you know, it's really mostly what you see up there is canoes and kayaks and ducks and turtles. So it's not really used much by boats. It's mostly just a, you know, human-powered part of the river, and of course this time floaty toys powered by humans.
Okay, let's go. Is it too late to sign up? It's this Sunday, right?
It's this Sunday, and we're taking ticket reservations until 10 p.m. tonight. We want to make sure everyone reads our safety plan and knows what they're doing. And it's just, yeah, so we urge people to go to chicagoriver.org as soon as possible to get their tickets, because we are limited to 500, and we want to make sure that you get your seat.
I think you'll get 5,000. Chicagoriver.org, chicagoriver.org. It's this Sunday, and they float off. What time do you launch?
We start at 12:30, and we'll be launching people in groups, and they'll just kind of be down the river with color and laughter and sunshine. It'll be a lot of fun.
Well done. Okay, I'm looking forward to it. Boy, I won't be there this year. I know I'm going to be out of town, but maybe next year. Margaret Frisbee, Executive Director, ChicagoRiver.org. Thanks, Margaret.
Thanks, John.
Man, doesn't that sound like a good idea?